We are online.
Live and online.
That's it. The last thing that we did was, the last subject that we covered was the conversation between Gideon and the people with regards to Gideon's future and the request that Gideon rule over them. Mishol banu. Gamata, gam bincha, gam ben benecha. Rule over us, you, your son, your grandson. Since the setting up of a dynasty, all of the trappings, the terminology, the references to the establishment of kingship, of Malchus. And Gideon's response in Pasuk Chav Gimel, Perakat Pasuk Chav Gimel, Vayomer alehem Gideon, lo emshol ani bachem, velo emshol bni bachem, Hashem yimshol bachem. I will not reign over you, my son will not rule over you, God will rule over you. Which reads like a kind of theological opposition to kingship. You don't need a king, God is your king. And it raises for us, for the first time in our study of Tanakh, it raises for us the question of kingship as a concept. Is what is the form of leadership that is preferable for Israel? Is it kingship? What is the Torah's attitude towards a king? What do we want to establish with the king? Why does Gideon say no to the appointment of Gideon as a Moshel or Melech, different from a Shofet? So what I thought we would do, we discussed it a little bit in the context of Gideon's local issues, but I thought I would take a kind of step back and use this as an opportunity for a couple of weeks, today, next week, hopefully just 2 weeks, maybe three, kind of do a subunit on the question of Malchus in Israel. Because even though it's really a subject that's discussed in more detail in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, request for a king from Shmuel in Perek Chet, it's really the subject here. Its place actually begins here. And for both internal reasons relevant to Sefer Shoftim and broad reasons relevant to the Tanakh as a whole, it's very important to understand the issues, the dynamics, and the variables related to the Tanakh's attitude towards kingship in this particular place. Hello, welcome back.
I really thought you'd be in Tunisia straightening things out over there.
They are waiting for me.
They're waiting for me. I don't care. The rabbi can.
No, the issue is Jocelyn has been in Tunisia, and that's why it's in chaos. She left all of them.
And I remind you that it all is recorded and placed on the internet.
I don't think they'll be listening in Tunisia.
All right. And as the story of the book of Shoftim will unfold in the next couple of chapters, particularly the aftermath of Gideon's and the story of Avimelech, we'll see increasingly that this dialogue between Gideon and the people of Malchus is pivotal. It's two psukim. It kind of gets obscured in the broader context of things, but it becomes the theme around which the rest of the Sefer is going to hinge and hang, because the very end of the Sefer will re-raise the question of Malchus. Bimim mahem ein melech b'Yisrael ish kol yashar b'enav yaseh, which is the way the Sefer ends, raises the question that states explicitly, the problem here is that we don't have a king. Everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes. The question of kingship was raised and rejected. So on the one hand, the book ends with this yearning, longing for the establishment of a king because the alternative is so bad. On the other hand, they had the opportunity for kingship right here and now. They offered it to him. And he turned it down, ostensibly on theological grounds. And that is a question that we need to to address. So we're going to take a kind of break or parenthetical unit on the question of Malchus and discuss it here. I want to divide the subject into three parts. One is we'll look at today, which is a sort of a fundamental question. Is kingship a form of leadership that the Torah embraces, rejects, acquiesces to, acknowledges? What is the attitudinal approach of the Torah to kingship? Issue one. Issue two, as we come back to Gidon, why is it specifically, what is it specifically about Gidon that raises the question of kingship here and now? And number three, what are the implications, long-term implications, both in the short-term and the long-term, of Gidon's refusal? Was he right to refuse? Was he wrong to refuse? Are there positive implications or negative ones? So those are the three major questions that we have to ask. There's a little postscript to the story of Gidon, which we haven't done yet, which is the end of Perikret. I'm saving that for the end of this unit. Okay, so that's my way of introduction. Where does our story begin? Our story begins, if we're going to ask the question of what the Torah's attitude towards kingship is, then of course, where is our story going to begin?
With the Torah.
In the Torah, Devarim Perek Yud Zayin.
Ellen and I could share.
No, I have more. I just picked up a pile in it.
Oh, it was the exact number.
I think it is. If I can count. So let's flip back to Devarim Perek Yud Zayin. Starting with Pasuk Yud Dalet. What is referred to in the Halacha as Parshat, actually there are two paragraphs in Tanakh that are referred to as Parshat HaMelech. When you hear Chazal talk about Parshat HaMelech, there are two references that carry that title. One is the mitzvah of Minui Melech in Sefer Dvarim, and the other are the parameters of the Melech, the authority and the powers of the Melech, as articulated by whom? Who articulates the powers of the king most explicitly? Say it louder. Shmuel. When the people... Right now, Perek Yud Zayin. Yes, we're going to go back to reread that Perek in Sefer Shmuel momentarily. Starting with Devarim Perek Yud Zayin Pasuk Yud Dalet 17:14. Ki tavo el haaretz asher Hashem Elokecha noten lach v'rishta v'yashavta ba. You will come into the land that God will give you. You will inherit it. You will conquer it. You will settle it. V'amarta asima alay melech kechol hagoyim asher sevivotai. You will say, let us appoint a king like all the nations around us. Som tasima lach melech, you will certainly... I just had a discussion last night with the kids from about Nechama Libretz. We used to drill into us every single time. You can't translate without commenting. No such thing as a translation that's not a commentary.
You said that on Shabbos.
I said that on Shabbos too. It just... And you hear it, you see it here too, because the Mefarshim are divided over how to translate the words som tasim. Typically, the phrase som tasim, I'm already biasing the conversation, but typically the words som tasim or the grammatical form of a verb doubled in Tanakh is usually a connotation of something which you must surely do. Patoach tiftach et yadecha. You will surely open up your hand to your brethren, the poor. other examples. Aser ta'aser, you will surely tithe when you tzedakah. It's this double verb, the first being the makor of the verb and the second being the conjugated form of the verb, which reflects usually this kind of emphasis. Here, the Mefarshim divide between those who say, who translate Som Tasim Olecha Melech as you will surely appoint yourself a king, and those who translate it as you may appoint a king. And that's part of the issue, but we'll come to it. Som Tasim Olecha Melech Asher Yivchar Hashem Elokecha Bo. You will appoint a king whom God will choose. Mikerev Achecha Tasim Olecha Melech, a king from amidst your brethren. You may not appoint a king who is not from your brethren. Similar law that exists in, or similar idea that exists in the American Constitution, requiring that the President of the United States be a natural-born citizen. You can't have a foreigner as a political leader of the people. It raises a very dangerous issue of dual loyalties. So, conceptually, that's the same idea here, from amongst your brethren, and the God will choose. Then the Torah goes on to delineate the limitations or parameters to this melech. Rak lo yarbe lo susim v'lo yashiv et ha'am mitzrayma. He may not have too many horses. And not return the people to Egypt, leman harbot sus, in order to obtain horses. Vashem amar lachem lo tosifun lashuv b'derech hazeh od. And we are enjoined not to return politically to Egypt ever again. V'lo yabelo nashim v'lo yasur levavo. May not have too many wives, lest they lead his heart astray. V'chesev v'zahav lo yabelo ma'od. May not have too much, amass too much gold or silver. V'hayach yishivto al kisei mamlachto. As he sits on his throne, he will write a copy of the Torah. He'll carry this Torah with him. In order that he should read it, and he should learn and fear God and to observe all the laws of the Torah. Livilti rum livavo me'echav, in order that he not elevate his heart above his brethren, arrogance, ulivilti sur min ha-mitzvah yaminu small, and not to veer from the Torah right or left, leman ya'arich yamim al mamlachto hu uvanav bekerav Yisrael. This will ensure the longevity of his throne. So, on the face of it, if we didn't know anything, we didn't know Sefer Shmuel, and we didn't know Sefer Shoftim, and we didn't know the historical debate, and we didn't know the Gemara, Machlok and the Gemara in Sanhedrin. We just read the Psukim as if we were reading it for the very first time. I know that's hard. That's like really hard. But if that was how we were reading these Psukim, what would we assume to be the parameters of, or the attitude of the Torah towards the appointment of a king? Favorable
with limitations.
I think that's a fair assessment. Favorable with limitations. In other words, the question of melech would get a yes. The question of melech on equal terms to every other society in the world in which the melech has certain broad scope, powers, and practices of political marriages and amassing great wealth in order to obtain a standing army and great power and horses and chariots and that component of Malchus, the Torah says, not so fast. We don't want too much of the trappings that other nations see or imbue in the kingship, but to the question of kingship, yes. To the parameters and powers, limitation. Fair. Based on this text, fair assessment. Which raises the interesting question, raises two textual questions. One is that we rarely find in the Torah, and this is the question the Mefarshim asked, we rarely find in the Torah a mitzvah predicated by the request of the people. One of the major issues that the Mefarshim struggle with is, why does the Torah introduce the mitzvah of the appointment of a king with the phrase, V'amarta asima alai melech kechol hagoyim? You will say, we want to appoint a king like all of the nations around us. Som tasim alech melech mikerev achech. What is the connection between the mitzvah of appointing a king and the request of the request of the people? That question is so strong that it leads some in the Mefarshim and some opinions in the Gemara to suggest that there really isn't an ideal mitzvah in the Torah to appoint a king. There's only a kind of hesitating agreement or acquiescence to the will of the people. If you request a king, God says, okay, I'll allow it. Because of this phrase, V'amarta asim alei melech. On the other hand, the phraseology with which the Torah formulates the mitzvah of a king is one of Som tasim alecha melech. You must appoint a king. And it's God granted and God appointed. God will choose. There's certainly, it's hard to say that that's something which the Torah doesn't want when it formulates it as, you must certainly do so. So this is where the debate begins. The debate takes on levels, because as it's applied historically, first level is in Sefer Shoftim, conversation with Gidon, where he seems to say, no, God is your king. We don't want kings theologically. He seems to base his hesitation on a theology of, in the Jewish world, we don't have kings, God is our king. And it's level two, Sefer Shmuel, where they also come to him and say, we want a king, and he gets very angry at them. And he gets very frustrated with them, ultimately to the point of God having to intervene and saying to him, it's okay, they're rebelling, but do it anyway. So I have two historical passages that seem to, if we're taking a vote in favor of a negative approach to kingship, and yet I have a mitzvah in the Torah that seems to present itself in a positive light.
Rabbi, which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Meaning?
The request for the king from the people?
Mm-hmm.
Or the mitzvah?
The mitzvah, the mitzvah is certainly in the Torah. The request comes later. But the phraseology in the...
Gidon was asked if he wanted to be a king.
Say that again?
Gidon was asked if he would be king.
Right.
By the people.
Right. Because that's how the Torah seems to phrase the mitzvah.
But that's my point. So it came from the human before it came from the...
Yet it's written in the Torah.
Right.
The mitzvah's in the Torah. So the mitzvah exists first. And that's the mystery of it. The mitzvah exists in the Torah. If the attitude of the Nevi'im later is negative because they understood that we don't want a melech, then why does the Torah put a mitzvah to appoint a king? Mitzvot are not optional. That's why they're called mitzvot, because they come from the word tzivur. Right? That's the mystery here. And it's even exacerbated by the fact that the very formulation in the Torah, this is the Torah itself, the very formulation in the Torah is, you will ask for a king, then you may appoint, you shall or you may appoint a king, depending on how you translate.
But that isn't that the same thing in the way, because it's the mitzvah is couched in a permissive, say, in other words, I don't read the Torah
mitzvah
saying...
The mitzvah is couched in both permissive and mandatory.
But isn't the first part that the people have to say, we want a king, before there's an obligation to have a king.
Not clear. Well, because Som Tasim Alecha Melech is a formulation. It's a mandate.
But before that it says...
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly the mystery. On the one hand, that's what I'm saying, that I have two phrases in the Torah that seem to contradict each other. One seems to say, it's permissive. If you want it, you can have it. You will ask for a king. Okay. On the other hand, I have a mitzvah that's formulated as Som Tasim Alech HaMelech. You must certainly appoint a king. That's the question. And I understand the intuition, and I understand the bias on the basis of Sefer Shmuel. In the Gemara and in the Halacha and in the Psak Halacha and the Rambam, however, it's very clear that this is not permissive. This is mandatory. And that's part of the problem.
But perhaps the ambiguity is about the word king. The king is a leader or is somebody with... Is like the king we have in other religion. He is appointed by God and is a kind of God. So,
is there a difference?
There is a difference in the definition of what a king is.
That's essentially what I think the second half of this paragraph is trying to set out. So once you establish that the Torah is mandating kingship, then you can go to step two, which is, okay, now what are the parameters, what are the laws, what are the limitations on that king? That's what I think is part two here. But I think the first question, and the question the Gemara is addressing, I want to look at that right now, is this a mandate or is this a permission?
Right, so that's my question. In terms of translation, I'm only going mm-hmm. in English.
Yeah, what does it say?
Grammatically.
Right.
To use the verb may.
Correct.
Is not
is
the
a bias.
Word
that's
has to.
Correct. But your translation is based on your opinion, based on your understanding of the passage. In other words, if you understand the passage, the Hebrew simply says som tasim. The Hebrew doesn't say may. The Hebrew says som tasim. Som tasim means must. In every other instance that the double language is used in Tanakh, without exception, it means must.
So why isn't it translated?
Because that's the debate in the halacha. That's exactly the issue.
No, but the rabbi's saying it's only. I mean, in every other in the
correct.
Translation, it's may. Why in another?
Because this translation has, as I said, every translation is an interpretation. In the halacha, there are two interpretations as to whether or not the mitzvah of a melech is a mandate or a permission. I will translate the phrase som tasim according to whichever opinion la halacha I accept. But the irony is that translation is not according to the halacha, because
right.
the conclusion in the halacha is that it's a mandate. Right? That's the interesting piece. So let's take
a
look at the Gemara.
There are other translations you're saying that don't.
Yes,
see
yes. absolutely.
I want to see it.
Oh, you don't believe it? They want proof.
I don't believe it. Get Art Scroll. Get our friend Art Scroll.
I don't think he is... I don't think it's going to help us, but just we'll just take a look and see. I can tell you how Nechama used to translate it. Nechama, by the way, what's interesting about translations,
right.
you should know, one of the reasons why Nechama was so... One of the reasons why Nechama Leibowitz was so... emphatic about translations is because her PhD, I just learned this last week, her PhD was on the German translations of Tanakh contemporary to the 19th century, 1920th century.
Wow.
That was her PhD thesis on. So that's
no
why it's a... Yeah, that's part of her whole methodology. You shall surely set over yourself a king.
You shall surely. That's different. That's totally different.
Because you can't work off a translation. You can never interpret on the basis of somebody's translation. Somebody's translation is always going to be an interpretation. So let's go back to the Gemara.
I was saying that last night when he was speaking to the girls, he said...
Right. We talked about Nacham a little bit. That's how you... Before you came. All right. So let's go to the Gemara. The Gemara is in Masechet Sanhedrin, source number one on the page.
Rabbi, can I ask you something else? This is probably much more philosophical, but usually when we have mitzvot in the Torah, there are mitzvot people can do.
Right.
From hindsight, we learned probably the best king was Shlomo, and he violated every single thing it said that you should not do.
I'm going to take issue with your assumption.
Okay.
That Shlomo was the best king we had.
Okay.
I would say that is not accurate.
Okay.
David, David, Chizkiyahu, Yoshiyahu, Yoshafat. I can list a whole bunch of kings who I think were far better.
Okay,
than Shlomo.
So aside from that, I understand her evaluation. I mean, but he did. They all violated.
The reality is that, that's it's nobody's perfect, and the Shoftim also failed. Ultimately, and this is the question that I think that we miss, is that in the 21st century, when we look at the issue, we're looking at the issue of what's the alternative. In our mindset, what's your alternative?
Democracy.
Democracy doesn't exist. The concept doesn't exist in the world of the Torah. There is not a government in the world. There isn't a philosophical framework for democracy that exists anywhere. The only forms of leadership that exist, you need an army, you need somebody to defend yourself, to protect yourself, you need somebody to lead the military. The only issues on the table here are, do you have a king, meaning one person, dynastically, responsible for the whole nation and the army of the entire people? Or do you have individuals responsible for military defense within regions of either tribal or geographic divisions within the people? The issue isn't king versus democracy. The issue is centralized versus decentralized form of kingship, shofet versus melech. Those are the only options.
And Yaakov had it set up from early on.
Well, that's exactly what we're going to talk about. The fact that the concept of kingship goes all the way back to the Avot. It was a promise to the Avot. It wasn't something which the Avot yearned for. God says to the Avot directly, Melachim mimcha yetzeyu, kings will come out from you. That's the bracha. We are too focused on the alternative of democracy and republic to kingship to realize that that's not the option here. The only alternative to melech is the nasi of the shofet, which is a form of malchus on a local, tribal, geographic level, decentralized. So now the only question is, do you have one king responsible for the whole nation and dynastically developing from generation to generation, or does each tribe look after its own political and military leadership, take the powers of the malchus and give them to each tribe independently? Not too dissimilar from the debate that took place in the early years of the American Constitution over whether or not the states would form a confederacy, or local states be responsible for their own militias and their own currency, or nationally. It was the same debate. Centralized or decentralized leadership. But in the terminology of Tanakh, the only options are at Melech or Shofet. So we can't make the mistake of thinking that the alternative to a Melech is a democracy. That doesn't exist. Right? That's the big question. The question in the Torah is, are you tribal or national? Those are the only two variables right now that the Torah would entertain. Separately from all of this, we could have a discussion, and we can add a component to the discussion as to what is the modern equivalent to what the Torah describes as a melech. Is a melech specific to concept of melech, or is there a modern equivalent that would meet the criteria of the Torah's terminology of melech without necessarily being called a melech? That's a great debate that took place in the 20th century between Rav Kook and others, who argued that the distinction between melech and shofet is between national government and tribal. The actual form of government is irrelevant, and therefore the powers or the authorities of the melech could just as easily be invested in a group of people democratically elected. They would have the same status as the melech. They would have the same role as the melech. So we could look at and talk about a national democratic government. The Torah would call that melech. The Torah would call that melech. In distinction to in, to use American terminology, each state having its own army and its own militia. The Torah would call that shoftim. Understand the difference? Those are the, that's the issue. Now we can come back in historically and say, well, the single person empowered with Malchus in the time of Tanakh was a failure. I'm not sure it was completely a failure. Over the course of 500 years, ultimately, it didn't pan out, but that's not necessarily because the institution failed. That's because that's part of our history. Right? We sinned before we had Melachim, and we sinned after we had Melachim. I don't necessarily think that you can blame the institution for the weakness of the of Israel as much as the whole process.
This three limitation in
the Torah, the is
very, very important, and we see that even today, because it was explaining that for a king, the problem is to become megalomaniac.
Megalomania.
Yes, it's exactly that.
And if everybody has understood that, we don't have all the dictators we have all over the world.
Unfortunately, I know quite a few democratic leaders who are megalomaniacs too. So I don't know that that's necessarily a.
And going back to Shlomo, exactly what happened to him.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the Gemara for a moment. Source number one. We still have to get to the story in Sefer Shmuel, which is going to be the focal point of our discussion. So I'm going to put that on the side. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says the following. That should be Rebbe Yossi Omer. For some reason, the first letter got squished. Rebbe Yossi Omer. Kol ha'amur b'parshat melech, melech mutar bo. All that is listed in the parsha, in the portion of the king, king is allowed to do. Here, the Gemara is referring specifically to parshat melech, not in Chumash, but in Sefer Shmuel. When Shmuel gathers the people together to appoint the first king of Israel, he delineates to them in an attempt to try to dissuade them from their request, he delineates the broad, extensive powers of the king. And he says, is this really what you want? And the people say yes. So the question that the Gemara raises is Shmuel describing offenses that kings are likely to do, or is he describing that which a king is entitled or authorized to do? What are we talking about? Let's take a look at it. Since we really can't understand this Gemara without Shmuel Aleph, Perek Chet. It may take us an extra week over what I had anticipated, but that's okay. That's okay. That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
332.
Perek Chet, from the beginning.
332.
Actually, I do, but I never realized. Vayhi kasher zaken Shmuel. And for those who learned Sefer Shmuel recently, this will be partially a review and partially perhaps a somewhat different approach, but that's why it's Elevel. Vayhi kasher zaken Shmuel vayasim et banav shoftim liYisrael. Shmuel was getting on in years, appointed his children as shoftim, which we will see in Sefer Shoftim is commonplace for the latter half of Sefer Shoftim. Post Gidon, that is not an uncommon phenomenon. It is quite uncharacteristic for the first half of the book, but not to the second half. Vahi Shem Beno HaBachor Yoel V'Shem Mishneu Aviyah Shoftim B'Ve'er Shava V'Lo Achu Banab B'Dvachav V'Aitu Achrei Abatza V'Aikru Shochat V'Yatu Mishpat. Shmuel's children did not follow in his footsteps. They were not exactly what we would call fine, upstanding citizens. Corruption can exist in the Shofet institution as much as it can exist in the Melech institution. V'yitkabtzu kol zikne Yisrael v'yavo el Shmuel haramata v'yemu elav v'yinei ata zakanta uvanecha lo achu bidrachecha. All of the zikenim, all of the elders gathered together by Shmuel, and they said to him, you are old. It's a very nice thing to say to him. And your children are not living up to your standards. Ata simalanu melech l'shofteinu k'chol hagoyim. Therefore, give us now a king to judge us like all of the other nations. Bezrat Hashem, when we finish Shoftim, we will study Shmuel. And there we will go through this parak in much more detail. One of the big questions is the answer that this is a classic non sequitur, because the excuses that they give seem completely unrelated to the request that they make. There's very little logic to the solution that they offer to the problems they've identified. One of the textual issues in this parak.
Get rid of the sons as judges, and maybe you don't need the king.
What does a king achieve that the son, that the judge made? So that's, I'll leave that for now. Vayera davar b'nei Shmuel, kasher amnu t'na lenu melech l'shofteinu. This was, Shmuel was very upset by this. He was very, embittered him. When the people said, give us a king to judge us, melech l'shofteinu, notice that he doesn't say that what upset him was that they asked for a king k'chol hagoyim. Many of the Mefarshim say that the reason why they asked for a king was because they wanted to be like all the other nations, and that's not nice. Shmuel doesn't say that that's what bothered him. All Shmuel says that what bothered him was that they asked for a king to judge us. So I leave that as an open question. Vayit palel Shmuel al Hashem. Vayomu Hashem al Shmuel. Shema b'kol ha'am l'chol ha'shayomru elecha. Listen to the people. Ki lo otcha ma'asu, they're not rebelling against you. Ki oti ma'asu mimloch alehem, it is me whom they are rejecting as their king. Going back to Gidon, who says, Hashem yimshol b'chem, God will be your king. K'chol ha'masim asher asu miyom ha'aloti otam mimitzrayim v'ad ha'yom hazeh v'yazvuni, as they have done since the day they left Egypt, and they've abandoned me, and they've worshipped other gods, v'yavdu alehim acharim, kein heim osim gam lach, now they're doing the same thing to you. The reaction of God is very harsh, maybe harsher than deserved. It's on the face of the request. V'yata shema b'kolam, listen to them. Ach, ki ha'ed ta'id b'hem v'higadeta lehem mishpat, Amelech asher yimloch aleihem. But you go tell them what the law of the king is. Mishpat Amelech. And this is where the Gemara raises the question, is what Shmuel tells them, the practices of corrupt kings, that you just to dissuade them, or what is what he tells them, the authorities that we would be granting to a king were we to go this road. Vayomer Shmuel et kol divrei Hashem el ha'am ha'shoalim meito melech. This is what he says to them. Vayomer ze yeh mishpat ha'melech ha'shem yimloch aleichem. This will be the law of the king. Et b'nechem yikach v'sam lo b'merkavto b'farashav. He will take your sons and put them into his chariots and his horses. V'ratzu lifnei merkavto, they'll run before his chariots. V'lasum lo sarei alafim v'sarei m'chamishim. He'll take your sons and he'll make them into captains over hundreds and over fifties and over thousands. To plow his fields, to harvest his crops, so that he can have food with which he will feed his army that he's now drafted your sons to populate, and making weapons of war. You need soldiers to make weapons of war, and so he will draft your sons to make his weapons of war as well as his armor for his chariots, or klei. That's as far as your sons are concerned. And what about your daughters? Ve'et b'notechem yikach. He'll take your daughters as well. L'rakachot, l'tabachot, l'ofot. For, what's the old expression? An army runs on its belly, right? Up until the modern era, women were not combat soldiers. But they were drafted for the support staff for an army. That's your daughters and your sons. What about your possessions? Vetzdotechem, vetkarmechem, vizetechem atovim. As for your fields and your vineyards, yikach, he'll take them. For what purpose? Minatan lavada, so that he can feed his enormously growing size of his army and his soldiers. Vizarechem, vicharmechem, yasor, he'll take a tithe off of your produce, whatever you're left with. In order to feed his government and officers, which is now growing at an alarming rate. We call that, in modern terms, we call that taxes. Right? We call it taxes to feed a growing government. Ve'et avdechem, ve'et shifchotechem, ve'et bachurechem atovim, ve'et chamorechem yikach. All of your workforce, your children and your servants, are all now subject of the king's authority to take, to draft, to include in his force, into his conscripted forces. Ve'esalim lachto. Tzonchem yaso. He'll take your sheep, he'll tithe your flock. Attempt to you lola avadim. You will essentially turn yourselves, not as citizens, into his subjects or servants. Uz aktem bayom umulifne malkechem. Then in that time you will cry out before your king, whom you have chosen, asher bechartem lachem. But v'lo yaneh Hashem etchem. God will not answer you.
So, one of your questions. Is he trying to dissuade the people?
Is the king of Israel granted, are these powers that the king of Israel is entitled to, or powers that the king of Israel could, that the king, in his emulation of other kings contemporary to him, would do, even if they're against the law? Essentially, here you have, what's the common denominator between all of these? All kinds of sweeping declarations. What's the common denominator between all of them? There's essentially one term that defines all of that which Shmuel has delineated.
Servitude.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. But, and that's how he says it. He defines it as Tiyula Lavadim. But what powers is he granting the king, or recognizing that the king has? Common denominator between all of this. Take your sons, take your daughters, take your land, take your fields, take your sheep, take your flock.
You're losing control. All your power.
No. Not control. Why does a king have the ability to take your sons? Why does he have the ability to take your daughters? It's called
an army.
The power of the king is to conscript the people into a standing, formulated, permanent army. That's the common denominator between all of these powers. The power to draft your sons, the power to draft your daughters, the power to confiscate land and take taxes in order to feed the army that he is creating, because the primary power of the king, the primary mandate and role of the king, is to create an army. Now, it's true a shofet also led an army. But the difference between the army of a shofet and the army of a melech is that the army of shofet is by definition a volunteer army.
No, but isn't a melech a permanent thing?
And the army of the Melech is a permanent army and a conscripted army and a forced army. Because that's the power of government. The power of government is to draft the people into armed services. If you look at all of the powers that Shmuel describes, they all revolve around exactly that issue. So that's the Gemara's question. Is Shmuel saying that the king has the power to conscript the population into his military force? Or that's described as an abuse of power of the king.
Why am I reading it as he's trying to dissuade the people from having a melech?
Because that's exactly what he is.
Yeah, that's what he's doing.
He's saying, you want this as the king that you've requested? You'll cry out to the king on that day and he won't answer you? And the people respond and say, Vayima anu'am, they refuse. Lishmo b'ko Shmuel, to listen to Shmuel's voice. Vayomulo, and they said, Lo ki im melechia aleinu. No, we want a king. That's exactly what he's trying to do. He's trying to dissuade them. He's saying, you're talking about a king who can conscript your children into a standing army. And the people say, right. Yes. Go for it. You got it. Shmuel, you hit the nail on the head. That's what we want. Why is that a rebellion? Torah says,
why do they want that?
And why do they want that? Okay, so we're going to learn more in Sefer Shmuel than we would have otherwise thought we would. Okay. Sanhedrin, the Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Chaf. That's exactly the issue. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Kol ha'amur bepashat melech, melech mutar bo. All these powers described to the melech in Sefer Shmuel are entitlements, powers of the king. The king, by definition, can conscript the population into an army. It's called a draft. Every modern government in the world has the power of drafting its citizenry into its military force. Reb Yehuda Omer, Reb Yehuda says, no, lo ne'emra parasha zu ela kadei la'ayem aleihem. Shene'emar, som tasim alecha melech, shetehe eimato alecha. This passage was said to inspire them with awe for the king. Reb Yehuda says they want to have reverence for the king. So he's describing to them the awe and reverence that a king will have, and the Torah's declaration of Som Tasim Alecha Melech, you shall surely appoint for yourself a king, means that the king is above you. Eimato Alecha, you have to have fear and reverence for the king, in a very positive type of spin. V'chein Ayad Rabbi Yehuda Omer. Similarly, Rabbi Yehuda was of the opinion, and this is consistent Rabbi Yehuda throughout the story, Rabbi Yehuda was of the opinion that Shalosh Mitzvot Nitztavu Yisrael B'Knisatan La'aretz. Bnei Yisrael were commanded three primary mitzvot that were incumbent upon them once they entered the land of Israel. Those three mitzvot are Lehamid Lehem Melech, Ulehachrit Zer'o Shel Amalek, Velivnot Lehem Beit HaBechira. To appoint a king, to destroy Amalek, to build a Beit HaMikdash. By the way, in the passage that's not here, but in the continuation of the Gemara explicitly states that these three mitzvot are chronologically dependent, in sequence. You may not engage Amalek till you have a king, and you may not build the base of Migdash until you have destroyed Amalek. Hence, the sequence was Shaul, who was appointed the first king of Israel, mandated to destroy Amalek next, fails to do so, leaves the job to David HaMelech, who finishes the job for him, and then Binyan Beit HaMikdash in the days of either David or Shlomo. The sequence is exactly that sequence historically. That's Reb Yehuda. Reb Nehorai Omer. Excuse me? Removed from?
Destroyed. He wasn't totally destroyed.
Amalek? That's a very powerful question, but relevant. No, I can't answer it today.
It's up for interpretation.
Well, everything's up for interpretation. But Amalek, it depends on how you define Amalek. The destruction of Amalek,
yeah.
Right? If you define the destruction of Amalek as every man, woman, and child, debatable. If you define the destruction of Amalek as the obliteration of Amalek as a threat, existential threat to the Jewish people, David HaMelech succeeded in destroying Amalek. Sefer Shmuel Aleph Perek Lamed, subject Bezrat Hashem, to be returned to. Rabbi Nehorai Omer, Lo ne'emra parasha zu ela keneged tar umotan. Rabbi Nehorai is of the opinion that for some reason has become very popular amongst the Mefarshim that the mitzvah of appointment of a king is not really a mitzvah. It's an acquiescence to the will of the people. They complained. God said, okay. That's the Tar'omet. Excuse me? Correct. Shene'emar ve'amarta asima alai melech. You had to make the request, so God said, okay. That's the opinion of Rabbi Nehorai. So ultimately, this debate as to whether or not kingship is ideal or secondary, something to look forward to or something to only have as a last resort, is really a machloket of the mefarshim, a barbanel on the negative side against most of the mefarshim on the positive side, really is a machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nehorai. Let's go one step. All right, let's go one step further. Tanya Rabbi Eliezer Omer. Zkenim shebador kohogen shalu. Shenemar, תנין לנו מלך לשופטנו. אבל עמי הארץ שבהן קלקלו, שנאמר, והיינו גם אנחנו ככל הגויים ושופטנו מלכנו ויצא לפנינו. Rabbi Eliezer offers what I think is essentially a compromise. I have two opinions, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Noorai, on two extremes, saying, one, we want a king, one, we don't want a king. Both working off the story in Sefer Shmuel. On the one hand, the mitzvah in the Torah says you want a king. On the other hand, Shmuel's response to the request for a king is so negative. God's response is negative. God says to Shmuel, it's a rebellion against me. What's the rebellion? The Torah says you're going to ask for a king. They ask for a king. So Rabbi Eliezer comes along and says, bifurcate it. There's two requests here. There's this Kenim, and there's the Am. And if you listen very carefully, you'll see that the request for the Zkenim, who asked kohogen, who asked appropriately, who asked at the right time, in the right way, in the right approach, their request was good. The problem was that the Am, the Amcha, the masses, they had a different agenda in place. And if you listen to the masses, you'll hear a different tone. It is they who destroyed the purity of the request for a king. And by adding the phrase, and now debatable as to what the phrase is that they added, Vayinu kam anachnu kochal ha-goyim u'shvatanu malkeinu v'yatza lefanim. We will be like all the other nations, the king will judge us and go out to be for us. I'm going to come back to Rabbi Eliezer, because that's the key, I think, to this whole story. But I certainly have two extreme opinions in the halacha as to whether or not a king is desirable. Rabbi Yehuda saying yes, Rabbi Noorai saying no. If you take a look in source number four is the Sifrei. Now the Sifrei is the Midrash Halacha that actually predates the Gemara. It's the halachic source upon which the Gemara is, or the Mishnah is based. And these, or the Midrash Halacha, these two opinions actually appear there as well. The Amarta Simalai Melech, Rabbi Noorai Omer, Harei Zeh Davar Gnai Li Yisrael, Shenamar, Ki Lo Otcha Ma'asu, Ki Oti Ma'asu Mimloch Aleihem. Again, based on Sefer Shmuel. This is negative. This God is saying to Shmuel, they're rebelling against me. They're rejecting me by this request. They don't want me as their king. They want an earthly king. Read Gidon. I will not reign over you. My children will not reign over you. Hashem Yimshol Bachem. Amar Rabbi Yehuda. But it's a mitzvah in the Torah. How can you say that it's an acquiescence when it's a mitzvah? You must surely appoint a king. If that's the case, so why were they punished in the days of Shmuel? Why was it considered a mistake? Because the request came too early. Because it was all about timing. All about timing, which I think is saying essentially the same thing that Rabbi Eliezer is trying to say.
How you ask as well.
It's how you ask and when you ask and why. It's ultimately a question of why. What's the motivating factor? Now, I'm going to go back to the story in Shmuel and I want to show you Rabbi Eliezer, but first, just to the last of the sources that I want you to see is source number three, which is the Rambam. The Rambam, when he codifies this lahalacha, which opinion does he codify? Rabbi Noorai, Rabbi Yehuda, or Rabbi Eliezer? The Rambam in Hilchot Melachim says, Shalosh mitzvot mitzvu Yisrael b'shat knisatan la'aretz, limnot lehem melech, lachvit zera shal malek, v'livnot beit ha'bechira. He quotes the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda verbatim, establishing the mitzvah of appointing a king as one of the 613 mitzvot. So, after all is said and done in the framework of understanding Tanakh, we have a psak halacha. And the psak is that the concept of kingship, call it national leadership, call it kingship, call it what you will, but the concept is the positive, desirable state of the Torah. The question of why the Torah formulates that as based on the request of the people, via Marta, there the Ramban adds that although the state of being is good and desirable, the timing is dependent upon the request of the people. Can't appoint a king until the people are...
Do you have anything else besides the barrels for the guy? Because he's here.
They were supposed to call me 10:30 now. Just the barrels in the closet. Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
It's all about timing. You can't impose a king on the people. The Nitziv in the Hamak Dover raises this observation. It's very powerful. He says, ultimately a king, by virtue of the fact that the powers of the king primarily are what? As Shmuel describes them. The powers of the king are primarily one of?
Army.
Conscription. The power to draft your children into military service in the army puts them into harm's way. You can't force that upon the people. So the Nitziv says that's why the Torah formulates the appointment of a king. Read king, national, army, force, conscription. It's read the whole sentence. That power and authority has to be valued by the people and requested. They have to invest the king with the authority to draft their children. It's an interesting observation, which may resolve why the Torah takes a mitzvah, which is formulated as a desirable and mandated mitzvah, and predicates it with the sentence of when you ask for it. Because ultimately that's the balance. Let's go back to Rabbi Eliezer. What is it here, what's the duality that the Gemara is picking up on? So if we go back to the text, we'll come to the chart in a second. But if we go back to the text, I'll show you a couple of nuances. Shmuel Perchet, the request of the people for a king. Remember, what is Rabbi Eliezer saying? Rabbi Eliezer is saying that there's two requests here. And they're different. One was correct, and the other was incorrect. What's going on? So the Gemara said, if you go back to the story, Pasuk Dalet, Vayidkabtzu kol ziknei Yisrael, Vayavo el Shmuel haramata. People gather together, they come to Shmuel, and they say to him, you're getting old, your children aren't walking in your ways. Give us a king to judge us like all the nations. For rephrasing the Torah's declaration, you will say, we want a king like all the nations. Shmuel's response is negative. God says to Shmuel, listen carefully. Their response, the Zkenim are okay. It's not you who they're rejecting. The Zkenim placed the critique on Shmuel. So God says to Shmuel, you've got it wrong. The Zkenim are putting the critique on you. That might be legitimate or not legitimate. That's a separate issue. But they're not rebelling against you. This isn't personal. They're really rebelling against me. There's nothing in the statement that the Zkenim made that would be conceived as a rebellion against God. But now look at the next sentence. Vayomer Hashem el Shmuel, Shma b'kol ha'am. Listen to the voice of the nation, the people. That's where the Gemara picks up the fact that there's two groups here. It's not Shma b'kol ha'zkenim. It's Shma b'kol ha'am. The Zkenim are the delegation. They come into Shmuel's office and they sit with him in his office and they're discussing it. Outside his window, there's a mass demonstration going on. God says to Shmuel, go listen to the mass demonstration. Go read their placards. See what they're saying. You'll hear a different language to the language that the Zkenim are talking. And in fact, when do you hear the people speak? At the end. After Shmuel delineates the powers of the king, Pasuk Yutet, Vayimanu ha'am lishmoa b'kol Shmuel. This is the response of the am. The Zkenim Tnulana Malcha Shoftainu Kachalagoyim. The Am Hayinu Gamanachnu Kachalagoyim Ushvatanu Malkeinu Vyatsa Lefanenu Vinilchamet Milchamotainu. Now, says God, according to Rabbi Eliezer, this Kanim's request, beautiful. Halavayef Mirgazoktis, they say. Wonderful. The Amcha, they blew it. Now, I'm not sure I understand the difference. What's the difference between them?
They both want to be like the other nations.
They both want to be like the other nations, so that's not the problem. Remember, I'm looking for something which the Zkenim don't say, but the Am does say. That's the key phrase here. So to resolve this, I set the psukim out. I laid the psukim out side by side. Okay, let's write it out.
But doesn't it say at the beginning of the year it says that they rejected me and that they?
That's God saying to God saying to Shmuel, they're not rejecting you.
Right. Yeah. So. Right?
I don't know, where did Shmuel come into the picture, right? So now take a look at the little chart that I gave you on the page, which is a divided into three columns. The left-hand column is the psukim in the Torah. This is the way the Torah delineates it in the positive. V'yamarta asima le'melech kechol ha'goyim. I've heard many people, contemporary, I've seen even in the Mefarshim, who place the emphasis on the problem, the fact that they want to be like the other nations. Terrible thing to want to be like the other nations, that's the source of the problem. Clearly, I think that the Gemara is saying that that's not the source of the problem. The Torah says being like in parallel to the other nations is not a negative. The Zkenim, Shalu Kahogen, who asked appropriately, their phraseology was, Ta simulanu melech l'shofteinu kechol agoyim. So what did the Amcha, the Amei Aretz, add that's not in the Torah, that's not in the words of the Zkenim?
The army part.
The army.
They want it to
Ki imelech yaleinu v'ayinu gamanachnu kechol agoyim ushvatanu malkeinu, till here is exactly as the Zkenim spoke, v'yatsa lefaneinu v'nilcham et milchamoteinu. That's why they weren't afraid of what Shmuel said. They applauded it.
They wanted to send their kids off to war.
They wanted a melech to create that army. Why?
For the discipline? Maybe they thought.
No.
No.
No, because no. Of their situation.
Now, there's a piece. Historically, the piece that's missing here is the motivation for all of this. The Shmuel, Shmuel sees the motivation in what the Zkenim say to him. What did the Zkenim say to him? The Zkenim say to him, you know what our motivation is? We want a shofet, we want a dynasty, we want continuity that's going to be pure, that's not going to be subject to bribes, that's not going to be subject to corruption. We want to avoid the corruption issue. We want righteousness, guaranteed. How the Malchus guarantees righteousness, interesting question. But that's what they want. What do the people want? They want an army. Why do they want an army? So if you take a look in Perek Yud Aleph, when Shmuel gathers the people together the second time to appoint the king, Perek Yud Bet, Pasuk Yud. Okay, Perek Yud Bet, starting with Pasuk, it's a whole piece from Pasuk Vav. Oh, we're going to run out of time. Whole piece from Pasuk Vav. Shmuel, as he appoints Shaul as the first king of Israel, gathers the people together and he says, I'm going to lay it on the line for you. I'm going to lay it on the line for you. And he goes through a whole history lesson. He starts with Yitziat Mitzrayim. He goes through all of the times that the judges in the period of Sefer Shoftim came to our aid and saved us from the hands of our enemies. Pasuk, middle of Pasuk Chet. וישלח השם את משה ואת אהרון, ויוציאו את אבותיכם ממצרים, וישיבום במקום הזה. God sent Moshe and Aaron, he took you out of Egypt, and he brought you here. You rebelled against God, he sold you into the hands of Sisera, into the hands of the Plishtim, into the hands of Moab. Pasuk Yud. Vayizaku el Hashem. You cried out to God. Vayomer chatanu ki ezavnu et Hashem and avodat ha-baalim et ha-ashtarot. We abandoned God. We've served Baal and Ashtoret. Save us from the hands of their enemies. This is a summary of Sefer Shoftim. Vayishlach Hashem et Yerubal vet Bedan vet Yiftach vet Shmuel. We saw these psukim once before. God sent you all of the Shoftim. Gidon and Shimshon and Yiftach and Shmuel. And he saved you from the hands of the enemies. However, that wasn't good enough for you. Pasuk Yudbet, Vatiru, ki Nachash Melech Bnei Amon Baalechem. Now, when you saw the threat of Nachash, king of Ammon, on your doorstep, Vatomru li lo ki Melech Yaleinu. Now we want a king. Vashem Malachichem Malachichem. God is your king. They believe in God. The question isn't believe in God. The question is trust. Right, that's exactly it. What did they have in Sefer Shoftim that they want to change? What's the equation that they want to change? Why does a melech change what they've had for 400 years? Why does a melech so dramatically change the equation? Shofet wasn't good enough for you for 350 years. Now suddenly you want a melech because there's a threat of an army?
They want a standing army. They want...
Correct. They want a standing army. They want a permanent army. They don't want an ad hoc army.
So that it's not a tribal thing. It's a permanent...
Correct. And therefore they want to transform from the Shofet to the Melech, from tribal to national, from ad hoc army to standing army. Why? Why is that theologically
a problem? Because it takes away their trust in God.
Because it takes away their dependence on God.
The dependence, that's the...
That's it. Takes away the dependence of God. The formula of Sefer Shoftim is the Shofet will come. He'll save you if you trust in God, if you abandon the idolatry, if you do tshuva. In their minds, the source of the problem is that they don't have an army, and therefore every time they're asked by a Shofet to go into battle, they have to first do tshuva. Nebuch. They've had enough. They're tired. If they have a standing army, they allow their children to go off into the army, into the draft. If they have a king, if they have a political process, they're not being asked anything anymore. It's all in the defense of the king.
Trust in Hashem, is it going to work?
Do they? That's why God says to them, they're making a terrible mistake. They think that by having a permanent army instead of a temporary army, then they're no longer dependent upon God. Then they can be dependent upon or beholden to God, is the better term. Right? And that's exactly the mistake they made. That's precisely the mistake they made. They're always going to be beholden to God. It doesn't make a difference if they have a king or a shofet, if they have a permanent army or a temporary army. That's what the Nevi'im came to tell the Melech. That's why there's a Navi designated to every Melech. That's the rebellion. That's the piece that they're not hearing.
Yeah, and that's why Gideon told them, Gideon foresaw that.
That's exactly what happened by Gideon. They come to Gideon and they say, Gideon, you were such a strong king, you were such a strong leader, you are the person to establish a permanent army, and we no longer have to be dependent upon God. And Gideon said to them, I'm not ruling over you, God is you. That's exactly what Hashem Yimshol Bachem or Hashem Malkechem means. It doesn't mean you don't have an army because God is going to fight your battles. It means you have to have an army that's equally as beholden to God as in a permanent state as it is in an ad hoc state. That's the dynamic of the issue. And that's what, Justin, you said before, that it didn't work, right? All those years that we had this king and it didn't work. It worked as long as, or somebody said that, it worked as long as we maintained our understanding of Sefer Shoftim, that our political, economic, and military situation is only as good as our spiritual loyalty to God. That's the message in Tanakh.
I mean, but Shmuel was the one that he wrote Shoftim, he wrote Shmuel, and in Shoftim he shows how that system doesn't work either.
Correct. Shoftim shows why we need a king. And the answer is, we do need a king. There's no question we need a king. That's exactly what Rabbi Yehuda is saying, and what Rabbi Eliezer is saying. We do need a king. There's value to a kingship. There's value to national unity. There's value to a king who represents all the tribes of Israel together and not tribal leaders that are warring with each other. No question. Had that been the motivating factor, it would have been ideal. That's exactly why the Gemara says there's a mitzvah to appoint a king, and why the Gemara says that had we asked appropriately and in the right time and in the right place, it would have been granted with open arms. But the context that motivated the people to request a king was not all that Sefer Shoftim pointed to. And that, I think, is ultimately why Shmuel emphasizes that point in Sefer Shoftim, because he wants them to understand there's a good side and there's a bad side. And that's the duality in the question.